Good evening, everyone. This is kind of another one of those solo webinars. I've given a lot of them, but I want us to keep moving. And this is a treatise on cosmic fire in depth, okay? And maybe I should put it this way, so that all the letters are represented. It looks like some kind of insect. Well, anyway, I'm going to be on a train when our next meeting occurs. Of course, I can try something from there, but I'm not at all sure that it will work, because there's so much breaking of the signal when you're traveling. So instead of relying entirely upon that, I will give the third in this series of introductory thoughts, offered first by Foster Bailey and then by Alice Bailey. And then we'll actually get into the fundamental material, but we'll leave the stanzas of Zian until later. If you want to study them, however, in video form, there are about 33 programs or videos on Makara, and maybe some of them on YouTube as well. And you can see what my impressions were. Obviously, when we work together like this, with questions and answers and all that interplay, things move more slowly. There are advantages and disadvantages. But here it is, the 28th of September. We've been talking about the five reasons why this book is being read and written, a fivefold purpose to it. And I think that I should just emphasize that a little bit. And we went over that before, of course, the skeleton outline, the subjectivity of it, and the truly subjective causes, the coherent development of the planet and the solar system, and really all atoms. That's the third, and the fourth is the practical information about the chakras and the centers of force within these various atoms. It takes it as far as the solar logos, but if we go just a little bit farther to a cosmic logos, page 293 of this book, we see that there are chakras that are of the nature of the sun. They are suns and solar logoi. And if we take it a little bit farther, we'll go into the realm of the unknown, who is, for practical purposes, the one about whom naught may be said. Okay. Now, obviously, not so much is said about the one about whom naught may be said, but we do know there are certain constellations in this great being, and our seven solar systems, of which ours is one of those constellations, along with the Little Bear and Orion and the Great Bear and Draco, and some others that are maybe a little less certain. Well, the parts of the Pleiades as well, very importantly. So the practical information about these chakras, and that fills in the, should we say, sort of the fifth ray component and the second ray work on detail. And then finally, we have some work on the devas and the elementals and the various creative hierarchies. What we know is that Master DK is an expert in all matters referring to the rays, to the local astrology of our planets and zodiacal systems, and also the creative hierarchy. So there is important information here about those groups of monads who travel together and who descend and then go, well, they descend in a way. They stay at home and descend at the same time. That's the amazing thing about the monad. A part of them descends, a projection, the prodigal son projection, we might call it, and then rises again and returns home. But meanwhile, in that descent has to deal with these myriads of sentient lives who are the essence of objectivity. Now, we stopped at that point, and I'll take up just a little bit more. This may be a shorter program, but I do want to cover the introduction, somehow do that, and then maybe together we can start working on the actual text. Now, I want to remind you that on Makara, all of this in detail is written out. We have maybe, I don't know, 1,100 and something pages of written commentary. It is written out. And then the last 100 pages or so are video commentary. Maybe I just got impatient. I don't know. But I figured I could do just as good a job with it, speaking about these arcane and remote pieces of information. So here we are then on number 3, and we're still in the introduction, and Alice Bailey is writing this. In studying this treatise, the student is asked to bear in mind, oh, by the way, I want to say that it's just about exactly the new moon in Libra, so that's a time of considerable emphasis on decision, and there are so many decisions to be made in the political world at the present time and maybe in our lives as well. So this is a time of the year when something from that great center, the bright center lying far ahead, the royal road being a Libran road and leading to that center, it's a time when important decisions can be made regarding one's spiritual life and in general, for people who are not into this kind of thing, regarding the life of humanity. Okay, so I just wanted to say that because I noticed it, and I thought, well, it's unusual that the exact full moon is occurring just about now. We might be a little late on it. I'm not sure. Let's just see. Five and five. Well, looks like it has just recently occurred. Yeah, just recently occurred. Within the last hour or so. Okay. Now, let's go on. In studying this treatise, the student is asked to bear in mind certain things, that in dealing with these subjects, we are concerned with the essence of that which is objective. Now, I did mention that DK is not going into a study of the densest matter. He's pretty well leaving that to humanity and to its scientists. He's working on the causal level, whether that causal level is very close to the physical plane or quite remote. He's working with the ethers and other things which are much higher. So we are concerned with the essence of that which is objective, with the subjective side of manifestation, and with the consideration of force and energy. Well, that's good to remember, because right away, you know, he's separating what he's doing from what even very intelligent people who are not esoterically learned can do. So it's substance, or it's, let's just say that he's dealing with that which substands objectivity. And they're all different layers of substandingness, you know. I don't like to use the word substance too much because it seems material, and I'm not talking about that. The one about whom naught may be said is a great substandingness or substance in our local cosmos system. If we go as far as we can go, we find the absoluteness to be the ultimate substandingness, the ultimate substance. It is well nigh impossible to reduce such concepts to concrete formulas and to express them in such a way that they can be apprehended by average man. And, you know, by average man, we mean the non-aspiring man. Well, he may be aspiring towards certain things in the realm of personality, but he's not aspiring towards the realm of spirit, because it's just not one of his cares or concerns at this time. There's much more to live through, I guess. Then point B, we have to bear in mind that as we use words and phrases and speak in terms of modern language, the whole subject necessarily becomes limited and dwarfed, and much truth is thereby lost. Well, yes, that is a difficulty. And we're not exactly working in Sanskar or in Sanskrit, the language of the gods. Maybe some of us will take that up. I remember a year of study of Sanskrit, and then very, very devoted study. And I thought to myself, well, after I did a bit and filled some big notebooks with it all, I said, well, this is going to take me 10 years. so, you know, it was a question of evaluation. And there are even, at this time, books that purport to indicate what the Sanskar is and maybe what it looks like, but it looks and it sounds and it shines, you know. It's an ideographic language. I think Chinese is a, and certain of the Eastern scripts, they are ideographic languages, but they have descended much, I think, from the living language which Sanskar is. So, okay, as amazing as this information seems to us, we have to understand that there is a reduction and a loss of truth. And the whole subject is much compressed compared to what it really is. Of course, DK sometimes says, look, I could expand all this. I could write many volumes, but he's being a realist and trying to understand what it is that humanity can really absorb. All right. And the third factor, that all that is in this treatise, is offered in no dogmatic spirit, but simply as a contribution to the mass of thought upon the subject of world origins and to the data already accumulated as to the nature of man. Well, this is one of the ways that Alice Bailey and the Tibetan protected the work. It's very easy to be dogmatic and defensive about one's teaching and to draw quite a ring pass knot around it and exclude the value of everything that is outside that ring pass not. That's the habitual, that's the common. But here with humility, they're saying, okay, we offer this, and it's not everything. As a matter of fact, compared to what we would like to offer, it is much reduced, and we make no absolute claims for it. You'll have to test this out yourself. The best that man can offer as a solution of the world problem must perforce take a dual form, and will demonstrate through a life of active service, tending to amelioration of environmental conditions, and through a formulation of some cosmological scheme or plan which will seek to account as much as may be for the conditions as they are seen to exist. So basic thing here is, you know, actually I want to let's see if I can do this. maybe not. Yes, I think I can. I've kind of fallen in love with a different kind of bracket, you know, and I know it's foolish, but I like this particular kind of bracket. And so one must serve if one is to gain everything possible from the reading. Otherwise, we just fill our heads with all kinds of arcane knowledge, and it accumulates, and it causes a congested and even poisonous condition. We have to express it somehow in helpfulness to our fellow human beings, to other kingdoms of nature, and to the planet. I was just thinking, you know, I was just involved in washing a little, giving a shower to a little chihuahua. I mean, when I look at how small those little beings are compared to the height of a man, I'm thinking about the giants and how the little men of the time must have appeared. And, you know, I just say, well, this is a service to a lower kingdom, and, you know, trying to get rid of some kind of infection and so forth. And I wonder how many times the solar angel turns some kind of a cleansing mechanism upon us to help us be rid of certain things that have accumulated in the aura. You know, I go for analogy at that point. So anyway, we have to, it's the dual work, dual path, and we have to learn and we have to serve. So we might say, learn and serve. Okay, and for some reason, everything became, yeah, that's, okay. Right, okay. Okay. So, we're looking for those deep-seated causes. This is a deep book. I mean, maybe it's presumptuous to say a look at cosmic fire in depth, but I've reviewed the book many times in different ways, and one always hopes to go deeper than one has succeeded in doing up to this point. And it'll take years, of course. Arguing as men do at present from the basis of the known and the demonstrated, and leaving untouched and unaccounted for those deep-seated causes which must be presumed to be producing the seen and known, all solutions as yet as yet fail and will continue to fail in their objective. So we just don't account for that which is subtle, for that which is subjective. It's not part of our universe of thought. Okay, we also have to bear in mind that all attempts to formulate in words that which must be felt and lived in order to be truly comprehended, notice, felt and lived. This is what I find myself trying to do in our Identify as Being group, not just to talk about it, but to have the experience within the heart, or maybe originating or from the heart, or having the heart used in the experience, that experience of being, if I can call it that. Okay. That all attempts to formulate in words that which must be felt or lived in order to be truly comprehended must necessarily prove distressingly inadequate. I mean, we're talking about things that even the Tibetan has not yet totally experienced, maybe not in great measure at all, but mentally he knows it is so. He says he has not been to the cosmic astral plane. And here we talk about the cosmic astral plane and that which lies beyond. All that can be said will be, after all, but the partial statements of the great veiled truth, and must be offered to the reader and student as simply providing a working hypothesis and a suggestive explanation. Well, if we can take our religion and philosophy in that manner, then it will do us some good. Some people absolutely want the dogma. They're so hungry for certainty that they insist on it, even if it's incorrect. At least they have the certainty. But partial statements is what we have here. And we have to take our intuition and go farther with it, if we can. And I think we can. Anybody who's really working in this kind of process knows that it's possible to carry things further than are indicated by the sentences themselves. But that, of course, has to be built up, that intuitive capacity. And right now, I think our job is not just to work in manas, but to work in what we might call buddhi manas, or manas buddhi, or mind stretching towards intuition, or concrete mind stretching towards abstract mind, stretching towards transcendental mind. That's what we have to do. To the open-minded student and the man who keeps the recollection in his mind that the truth is progressively revealed, it will be apparent that the fullest expression of the truth possible at any one time will be seen later to be but a fragment of the whole. Not only that, but if we believe in greater beings, if we become convinced that they do exist, we will realize that their scope of understanding must be much greater than our own. So just little, the truth at any one time, the truth possible at any one time, will simply be later seen as a fragment of it. And we must not have such a drive towards closure, because certainly, given what we know and can know, we will close prematurely. And later still be recognized to be only portions of a fact, and thus in itself a distortion of the real. So we are being fed illusions, but very partial illusions, and they are less illusory than what we've been entertaining. Now, DK says we finally overcome illusion, and I suspect that is with regard to the cosmic physical plane at the ninth initiation. Now, that's lying far ahead of the Christ. So patience and persistence are absolutely required of us. This treatise is put out in the hope that it may prove useful to all broad-minded seekers after truth, and of value to all investigators into the subjective source of all that which is tangibly objective. And in terms of our universe, that would be the universal logos. You know, it's so interesting. There's all these stories around any great individual. Einstein was a great individual in terms of the revelation that he brought from, kind of the fifth ray ashram and the third ray ashram. It's hard to know whether it was the fifth ray ashram per se or the fifth ray as it works under the third, but factors involving both of those were present. And why did I say that? That's going to be the question. Yes, it would be the question of Einstein's desk. There's all these stories. What did he have on his desk, you know, when he passed away, and what was remaining on his desk? Well, you name your enthusiasm, and probably some kind of book representing your particular enthusiasm is on his desk. But I have heard that, you know, he did allow the print of his hand to be taken. There is an inked print that shows, very interestingly, it's just kind of a free floating headline. So I guess he was interested in palmistry, and whether or not there was a book on palmistry on his desk. Some people say yes, and other people just point to the fact that he very definitely allowed the print of his hand to be taken. And then reports are that a treatise on cosmic fire was on his desk. Well, you know, probably anybody who knows for certain whether that's true or not has long since passed away. We won't know, but the story is interesting. He had great philosophical interests, and I told you already, I think, that in some other program that he had written the foreword to a dictionary on Spinoza's work, the philosopher Spinoza, who may very well have had similar rays to Einstein, maybe the third ray soul and the second ray personality. So anyway, I thought I'd mention that. Anyway, the book, Broad-Minded Seekers, for Broad-Minded Seekers. It aims to provide a reasonably logical plan of solar systemic evolution, and to indicate to man the part he must play as an atomic unit in a great and a corporate whole. Well, man is, to what being is he a molecule? To what being is he an atom? To what being is he a subatomic particle? To what being is man as a bubble in the koilon, which is, according to Leadbeater and Besant, the smallest unit that we can find on the cosmic physical plane? And we don't even know whether that is divisible or not. This fragment of the secret doctrine, this book, is the turning of the evolutionary wheel. In the turning of the evolutionary wheel, goes out to the world making no claims as to its source, its infallibility, or the correctness in detail of its statements. So no claims, you know, and you always have to be really suspicious when people claim to be an initiate, you know. what kind of initiate, and when such and such a book claims to be a channeling from the master, you have to observe carefully, analyze, and see whether logically and intuitively it adds up. But Alice Bailey takes care of that. She says, look, take it for what it suggests to you. We make no claims, nor do we speak in bated breath of this being from the master. And maybe that would have persisted if that mistake which Alice Bailey made, putting Joao Cool, I think his name, at the bottom of a document instead of the Tibetan. I think she, you know, gave his name inadvertently, not on purpose, it just happened. And from that time on, everybody knew that the Tibetan teacher was the master Joao Cool. And then, of course, the tendency to take the master's word as gospel would persist, or would be inaugurated and persist. No book gains anything from dogmatic claims or declarations as to the authoritative value of its source of inspiration. I guess she's even including the Bible, you know, I suspect. It should not stand or fall solely on the basis, it should stand or fall solely on the basis of its own intrinsic worth, on the value of the suggestions made, and its power to foster the spiritual life and the intellectual apprehension of the reader. Yeah. Well, that is a statement. We live in an age of insecurity, and people really want to be certain of things, so they'll jump at the certainty before they have ascertained the accuracy of their supposition. Okay, that's how people are, and sometimes they'll substitute, often actually, substitute the truth or relinquish the truth for certainty. And that certainty that they have, somehow deep within themselves, they know they are forcing it, and they're not really certain. If this treatise has within it anything of truth and of reality, it will inevitably and unfailingly do its work, carry its message, and thus reach the hearts and minds of searchers everywhere. So this is, you know, what can we say here? I think the attitude is demonstrated of detachment. Is demonstrated. If it is of no value and has no basis in fact, it will disappear and die, and most rightly so. There just won't be enough interest to keep it alive, right? But I think A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, almost 100 years old now, has certainly demonstrated its value, at least to certain types of minds. And we'll just have to wait to find out whether it really was on Einstein's desk. Somehow, you know, that third ray that he has, and that intelligent, the acute ray of divine mental perception, it's come to be kind of a symbol for human intelligence. But I'm sure there were other human beings just as brilliant in their own way, even on the third ray, as I suspect he was. All that is asked from the student of this treatise is a sympathetic approach, a willingness to consider the views put forth, and that honesty and sincerity of thought which will tend to the development of the intuition. Now that's interesting. That honesty, truth. that honesty and sincerity of thought which will tend to the development of the intuition. Meaning, if we tell the truth, think the truth, the intuition within us will have a much easier time developing. So we'll tend to the development of the intuition of spiritual diagnosis. These are the things that honesty and sincerity of thought lead to, and a discrimination which will lead to a rejection of the false and an appreciation of the true. Obviously, you know, our minds are not yet extraordinarily developed. I don't know, should we say we just haven't had time or have taken too many turns in the wrong direction. But we are members of the fourth kingdom of nature, pushing on the fifth, and we know the kingdom of souls, the members of the fifth kingdom, certainly have a greater appreciation of the truth than we, and on it goes in the various kingdoms and ascending hierarchies. And yet somehow the realization that there is but one being in cosmos and all these different emanations are at different stages of their descent or of their unfoldment is comforting, because we know that once again omniscience will be ours, and omnipresence and omnipotence, as ever it has been cyclically in relation to every appearing universe. Now, that whole thing about whether, you know, there's cyclicity in this universe, whether universes appear cyclically, or whether there's some kind of steady state and ongoing universe, I suppose has to be submitted to a kind of science that we don't even have yet. And you find the supporters of each of those different points of view, and then you find the supporters of the idea that there was but one Big Bang, and maybe mostly in relation to the physical plane, because everything higher is seen by such people as derivative of matter. So all you need is the matter, and you can make up to create the subjectivity. But, you know, that's not too logical from our point of view. So these things will have to be sorted out, and I think that there are some people adhering to the Big Bang. I think I heard one speak. He was involved with the CERN, the CERN atom smasher, and they were talking about, well, what about before the Big Bang? Was there a before? And the man seemed to say, well, there had to have been. So I'm sure there's much uncertainty in certain advanced thinkers who treat the Big Bang as if it is the major event, but they don't have anything else to substitute in its place or anything else with which to precede it. Occultism does have that. Matter of fact, occultism deals with the infinite in such a way that it would probably be pretty roundly rejected by the people who are, as they seem to think, sticking to the facts and sticking to the observable. I think Master R. encouraged that, or let's call him Francis Bacon, encouraged that sticking to the observable and that which could be experimented with, because scholasticism, I think, had left the earth, so to speak, created too many castles in the sky to be accurate, and was not leading towards the revelation of real truth. So a corrective was needed. The words of the Buddha most appropriately have their place here, and make a fitting conclusion to these preliminary remarks. The Lord Buddha has said, I guess this, I think we find this in most of the books, Or we certainly find in the foreword by the Tibetan this idea that we must not believe in a thing merely because it is said. Well, we tend to. If the sayer has a lot of authority, nor traditions because they have been handed down from antiquity. Well, there's some bias in the human being. If it's old, it's solid. Almost every company will tell you it's been in existence since XXXX, you know. And the longer ago it came into existence, the more you are to trust it. We know we have this. They were not to believe in rumors, nor rumors as such, because lots of things get said and they get spread around, and who's to ascertain their accuracy without putting them to the test? Nor writings by sages, because sages wrote them, not just based on reputation of the sage, because we have to test what is said. Now, of course, I think people like you and me, we come to a point of trust where we give the Tibetan and certain teachers, like Master Hilarion and Master Kutumi and Master Moria, maybe, you know, well, not maybe, but definitely, it's just a question of the translation of the impression and how accurate that is. And that's another subject. We tend to believe because they have proven themselves in so many ways, and so we don't waste time arguing with the source. Nor are we to believe in fancies that we may suspect to have been inspired in us by a deva, a shining one, you know, not necessarily a low deva or a high deva, but a godly being. Where did that come from? Where did that impression come from? Was it my own imagination, or was it really an impression, an inspiration? And just because we think of its source as being from a shining one, a deva, doesn't mean we should believe it simply because of its source. Again, we have to put to the test that which has arisen within us, or that which has been impressed upon us. Nor from inferences drawn from some haphazard assumption that we have made. Maybe suddenly we grab onto an assumption. I've done that frequently, you know, and I hope that it hasn't been entirely haphazard, but it might be too much in that direction. And then you sort of grasp something and you say, well, maybe that's true. Then you repeat, maybe it's true, long enough, and it becomes true. And then you start drawing the implications from that true-seeming assumption, which began in a relatively chancy, haphazard manner. So just because we think it doesn't mean it's true. Nor are we to believe, nor because of what seems an analogical necessity, but I must say, that's a step in the right direction. Because analogy is the great interpretive law in the universe, and the law of correspondence is even in more detail as an aspect of the law of analogy. Nor on the mere authority of our teachers or masters. See, in other words, the Buddha is saying the source itself may be relatively trusted, but it's insufficient for us to give our full assent, full belief, simply based on the way we value or venerate the source. We may venerate the source, but that's not enough. And that is a hard saying, because it fights against the sense of certainty we would like to have. Nor on the mere authority of our teachers or masters, but we are to believe, now the positive part, when the writing, doctrine, or saying is corroborated by our own reason and consciousness. Now that's by the mind, and even better yet, by pure reason, which is of the intuition. Because pure reason is straight knowledge, as Master Moria calls it. And there is no doubt, so impressive it is, so necessary, so unavoidable. It's not just I'm reasoning, I may get there, I may not get there. The pure reason strikes you, and you simply see this is how it is, and you don't have to use reasoning to arrive at your conclusion. For this, says he, in concluding, that is the Buddha, I taught you not to believe merely because you have heard. Okay, it's hearsay. It may be correct, it may not. But when you believed of your consciousness, then to act accordingly and abundantly. In other words, when it became so interiorly convincing, based upon its own merits, and not just because of the authority of the source. This is really a little paragraph leading us away from authoritarianism and into our own abilities to confirm or deny the truth of something that has come from a venerated source or a fairly believable or very believable source. We cannot sort of think ad hominem, you know, think of the man who said it. Of course, that's somewhat inevitable. The human being who said it, no. Although it can be influential if we feel who Christ is or Jesus and they say something, we tend to give it the benefit of the doubt. And I'm sure that people such as we are, if the Tibetan appeared before us one fine Sunday morning while everyone else was in church, as happened to Alice, we would tend to believe. Apparently she did believe somehow deep down in her when he said, there's some work you can do for us if you will stop being such a naughty little girl. In any case, something stuck with her, and it was probably the seed of much thought and altered behavior. So the Buddha, in his last sermon, emphasized the idea, rely upon yourself. He sought to throw back the reliance that so many students have upon their teacher, almost waiting for the next word of truth to drop from their lips, and without thinking themselves, not climbing the mountain of vision by themselves. But he threw that responsibility back on them, because after all, they are souls, they are triads, they are monads, they have the source of truth within, and he wants them to become self-reliant. That's the main theme of that final sermon. And when you think about it, you know, it's very strengthening. The Buddha had a lot of the first ray. He was a first ray personality, or at least, well, you know, that's interesting because Prince Siddhartha obviously was not the Buddha. But as Jesus was to the Christ, so Siddhartha was to the Buddha. This is my formulation, I think. But anyway, we're told that the Buddha had or used a first-rate personality. And we're also, it's also hinted on page 518 of Dina 2 that the Buddha was on the first sub-ray of the second ray, the Christ on the second sub-ray, and someone like Master DK on the third sub-ray. So the Buddha was impressive in terms of the first ray, but he made it a requirement that people did not just depend upon him, but rather depend upon themselves. And when you think about your own nature, on what do you depend? Or on whom? I mean, certainly if I read something from the Tibetan, I give it the assent of probable truth from the very beginning. But then if I really think about it meditatively, I may ascertain, make certain, in my deliberations, the way that it is true. And then I'm climbing the mountain of vision by myself. So may this be the attitude, may this be the attitude of every reader of this treatise on cosmic fire. So Alice Bailey is certainly protecting the way and protecting the devotional or protecting the teaching from the biblicizing, you know, the devotional tendencies of adherents who would like to have every problem solved for themselves by the teacher. It gets into the Bucyrus fault in the labors of Hercules, relying too much on the teacher till we see through the teacher and find that really we must rely upon ourselves. There's a little more in the footnotes throughout this treatise. The secret doctrine by H.P. Blavatsky is designated by the initials SD. The page references are to the third revised edition. I got a hold of such an edition that was falling apart, and basically it was the edition that had belonged to the last living disciple in the Tibetan group. And she had done a lot of work in it, you know, but it was pretty well boxed up and put away for eternity, and when she passed on, she had given Keith Bailey and myself pass rights to her material. And it's nice to be able to go to a page where a reference is actually found. Fire. A little bit more. What says the esoteric teaching regarding fire? Fire is the most perfect and unadulterated reflection in heaven, as on earth, of the one flame. I guess it has different ways of demonstrating on different planes, and so even in the middle heavens and even in high heavens, it's still a reflection. I guess seventh heaven is the logoic plane. And then we have reflection in a lower demonstration in our worlds. Somewhere it says that the life of these elemental beings is fire itself. But it's more than that. It is life and death, the origin and the end of every material thing, from the fire, to the fire, through the fire, and then free of the lower fires into a still greater fire. In a way, maybe fire is anything that emerges from the beingness of the universal logos. We're taking it higher. Fire is all the aspects of absolute infinitude, and whatever somehow mysteriously beyond thought emerges from absoluteness, or the absolute, is fire. It is divine substance. It always stands behind form and is the cause of form. There are some beautiful statements about fire. I wonder if my memory will serve me. Maybe not, and if it doesn't, I won't spend too much time. But as I recall, in the rays and the initiations, around page 81 or 82, I don't know, somewhere in here, is a beautiful definition of fire. Otherwise, I'll have to go to the Alice Bailey extracts, which I hope you have. Here it is. I've been lucky. Fire is the sum total of that which destroys form, produces complete purity in that which is not itself, generates the warmth which lies behind all growth, and is vitality itself. Now, this is one of the really fine definitions, page 82, the end of 82, in the Rays and the Initiations. Fire is the sum total of that which destroys form, but apparently form also emerges from the fire, considering fire in another way, produces complete purity in that which is not itself. So certainly we have to be subjected to the burning ground, as there's no onward passage for us until we have a degree of purity. Generates the warmth which lies behind all growth. We're not going to grow in the deep freeze. And is vitality itself, life in a way, a reflection of life. Divine substance. All right, so this is somehow a very beautiful statement, and one that we have to regard as important. On earth, and our earth and man are the product of three fires, and we know what those fires are, or at least we have the words. Fire by friction for man, the lower 18 subplanes. Solar fire for man, the three higher subplanes of the mind, plus an additional 14 subplanes that include the triad, especially the atmic and the buddhic part of it. And then electric fire. Maybe we can consider this certainly the highest seven subplanes, and probably the monadic plane as well, although you kind of wonder if there's not some solar fire blended into that, as it is the second plane. So these page numbers, yeah, they are related to the third edition. Fire and flame destroy the body of an arhat. Their essence makes him immortal. Now we're talking about the fourth degree, because I think that's when the term arhat begins to be used, and the fire and flame will burn up the causal body. There are different ways of destroying the causal body, and they're found around page 15 or 16 or 17 in there of Letters on Occult Meditation, but eventually flame will consume the causal body, but that flame is a high essence, which is the essential immortality of such a being who is relinquishing the scabbard of the sword of flame. When the vehicle on the higher mental plane, Solomon's Temple, burns, it's just the relinquishing of the outer form. It's inner to us on the outer planes where we are, but it's outer compared to the spirit. All of this from the Secret Doctrine. And what else? Well, that's it. That's it, friends. So we've spent just about an hour here, and which is good. And then in three either discussion webinars or solo webinars, we have gone through this introduction, and maybe the next time we meet, I don't know if on the train I can do anything, but if I can, I will. You can try me. I may be gone and unable to do it, you know. But maybe not. We can ask questions about this. So the next thing that we're going to be dealing with is the actual text, starting from page starting from page 3. So for right now, this is the third in a treatise on cosmic fire in depth, and we will go on with the text the Tibetan has provided. Okay, we'll be seeing you. It's a great book, and on Makara are all of these written commentaries. I'm sending them to you as we go along, but you may want to read them carefully and see if it helps you study. It's a book deserving great study, and I hope that what I've written down is of some value to the serious student. Certainly was of value to me to think in that way, but, you know, I'm not there yet, and I don't think any of us is, so one day we will be. All right, so this is the third, and I'll send it out to you as soon as I convert it. Bye-bye for now. Lots of love, many blessings, and we'll see you soon.